Hogwarts, 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 teach us something.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies.
Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Audrey.
And I'm Katie.
And today we are going to be talking about one of the most controversial and debated characters in the series. This is a big one, folks. Professor Albus Dumbledore. All right. So, as a warning at the beginning of this episode, we realize that Dumbledore has a ridiculous amount of stuff to talk about. And our next episode is going to be on Crimes of Grindelwald, so we'll get into a little bit of him then. But don't expect this to be the last Dumbledore episode, especially with us still learning things with the Fantastic Beasts series coming out and a lot of things being up in the air. And like I said, him being really controversial and debated character, there's a lot to get into, so we may revisit. And if you listeners have anything that you think we miss or you want us to talk about, then let us know with regards to Dumbledore. So before we start this out, Katie, let's get a little bit of a straw poll of where we feel on Dumbledore, just so everybody knows our bias going into this.
So, I mean, I definitely am a Dumbledore fan. I think that just he's this amazing character that is there for Harry throughout all the series. You can talk about why a little bit later. Maybe he was there for different reasons, but he's such a good character, and he's just this such warm and all-knowing professor. He just is so cool. I'm going to compare him a little bit to Snape right now, because his whole storyline is throughout all the books, people loved him. Like, he was one of the best characters. There was no real reason to dislike him until maybe the seventh book, and then people's opinions might have changed. And so the same thing kind of happened to Snape, but in reverse. So Snape was bad throughout, like, all the series, and then maybe at seven something, we got some new information and opinions might have changed. And I think that it's more important to me how people were throughout the whole series than just these, like, little pieces of information that might put things in more context, but I don't think that makes Snape not a bad guy, and I don't think that makes Dumbledore not a good guy, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think the first time we talked about our feelings on Dumbledore and Snape, we kind of said that for the same logic as us both not becoming Snape lovers with what's revealed in Deathly Hallows, we both also did not become Dumbledore haters for that, the information that we gained at the end of Deathly Hallows. I think Dumbledore is one of my favorite characters. I usually don't list him, but I love this guy, especially whenever I reread the series. I really love how just badass he is. He's literally the greatest wizard of all time, I think. And, I mean, I think, yeah, there's no denying the good that he's done. And, yeah, I know that he has some faults and he's manipulative, and we're going to get into all of that, but everybody has their flaws, and I think that the good definitely outweighs the bad for Dumbledore.
I think so, too. And getting back to what Audrey's saying, that if you guys want to email us anything you want us to talk about in regards to Dumbledore, anything we missed, you can also email us with your reasons why you dislike him, if you do.
Yeah.
Because it's always very interesting to see where different people come from on, especially Snape and Dumbledore.
Yeah, I love to hear the different beliefs. So let's get into
it. And I like to hear why specifically. So we're going to start off talking about Albus's name, which is a little bit of a doozy. So his full name is Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore. And I think we hear this for the first time in the Order of the Phoenix, maybe, when he says his full name at the trial.
Yeah.
I don't know if we hear it before then, but I know we hear it then. He, like, walks in and he says his full name. So we're going to break down each of those names and kind of the meaning and where they come from. So starting with Albus, that means bright or white, which I think plays really well into Albus's character. You know, the white beard, the white hair, and also the twinkle in his eye could be the bright section. And then this is also interesting because Ariana means silver and Aurelius means gold in terms of his known / unknown family members. And then Aberforth means from the river, which is also really interesting because that kind of mimics the relate, like, who all those people are. Like, Aberforth is just kind of more lowly, more common than the rest of his siblings, especially in terms of Albus. So Albus can also be, the name Albus can also be tied to the Italian word for sunrise, which is alba, and that could be a reference to the phoenix imagery with the Dumbledore and Albus, the Dumbledores and Albus especially, because, you know, the rebirth of the phoenix, which is like the sun and the fire that the phoenix is born out of. And then his first middle name, Percival. Percival is the name of one of the knights of the Round Table in King Arthur. And as we've mentioned before, JK does pull some imagery and names from references to King Arthur, because we talked a lot about that in the Excalibur and how that's connected to the Sword of Gryffindor in our Gryffindor episode. Percival was actually the knight that got a glimpse of the Holy Grail. So Percival, in terms of Albus Dumbledore in this series, is the name of his father, and so that's kind of where we get that name, and then also it could be similar to Percy Weasley. And then his second middle name, Wulfric, comes from the words wolf and power, and this could be reminiscent of Beowulf, who slaughtered the monster Grendel, which is similar to Grindelwald, actually, in his youth, and was fatally wounded by a dragon in a sea cave with only his young orphan squire to help him. And this could be really reminiscent of this scene in Half-Blood Prince when Dumbledore's in the cave with Harry, and he doesn't quite die in that scene, but that leads to his death, and Harry is obviously an orphan, so that's very similar to that. And then Brian means higher noble.
I think the Brian inclusion, I always thought of it as like comic relief, but it's really funny that it actually means like high or noble when it really sounds like it's like kind of the commonplace name out of all of this, like Albus, Percival, Wulfric, Brian, Dumbledore.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. I think when I first heard that, I thought that one was very out of place with the rest of his names. And then his last name, Dumbledore. So this is a dialect. This comes from a dialect of Old English, and that word Dumbledore means bumblebee. And then in a 1999 interview, JK actually explained why she chose Dumbledore as his last name and the reference to bumblebee, because she always imagined him kind of humming or flittering around his office like a bumblebee does, just pacing around his office. And then some information from the lexicon. So Christopher Wolseley writes in reference to Dumbledore, although not widely known, an alternate meaning for the word Dumbledore is a style of hat that was made semi-popular in London in the 1880s and 1890s. Taking this meaning into account, Albus Dumbledore's name would have the meaning white hat. As I'm sure you know, this is a term for the hero or protagonist of a story. Miss Rowling named her great champion of good White Hat. I ran across this alternate meaning while researching a paper on British literature in the 19th century. And so we know that JK has said that she chose this name mainly for Bumblebee, but we kind of can surmise that she might have had this ulterior meaning at the same time.
Yeah, she definitely knows at least that meaning. Like, that doesn't get, something yeah. like that doesn't get by JK.
No.
So, Dumbledore, all we know about his birthday is that he was born in 1881. We don't know the actual day of birth. But just for some context, this means he was around 100 when Lily and James were killed. So, the first fall of Voldemort. And it means he was about 115 when he died. And then I guess he would have been like in his mid-40s when we see him in Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald. Because that happens in 1927.
Yeah, and then so his wand, the wand we see him use throughout the Harry Potter series is made of elder wood. And the core is thestral hair and it's 15 inches long. And spoiler alert, it's the elder wand. We do see him use a different wand in Fantastic Beasts because Grindelwald obviously has the wand at this point, so he can't have it. And this wand, I don't know if we know any information about it. I didn't really look into that because we might talk about it in our Crimes of Grindelwald episode, and I'm sure we'll have a separate episode on the Elder Wand itself anyways, but his wand that he uses in Fantastic Beasts is, like, really cool. Like, it looks really cool. I want it. And then I have both of Dumbledore's wands because I own the Elder Wand already.
Yeah, that'd be super cool. All right, and then his house when he was at Hogwarts was Gryffindor. I believe this is mentioned, like, by Hermione at the very beginning of Sorcerer's Stone, because they're on the train and she says something about kind of wanting to be a Gryffindor, and she heard that Dumbledore was one. I was, like, kind of looking into this a little bit more because I feel like it's not super straightforward and obvious with Dumbledore. I think he really has qualities from all the houses, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons he makes a good headmaster. Gryffindor, I think, is pretty clear. Like, he's very brave. He's a leader of the fight for good. He stands up for good. And I think he truly values bravery probably more than anything else, at least in the time that we know him best, which is later in life. As far as Slytherin, I think he was really ambitious and cunning. He was particularly ambitious and wanted power in his youth. We see that with his relationship with Grindelwald and the pursuit of the Deathly Hallows. And, I mean, he's witty, and JK has described him as bookish, so Ravenclaw could be a fit. And then he clearly values everyone and believes everyone deserves an education. And, like, he's referred to as muggle-loving, and I think those are kind of some Helga Hufflepuff-esque traits. And I actually found a Reddit thread about him being, or maybe he should have been a Slytherin, an argument for that. Some fans believe he could have been like Slytherin, Gryffindor, almost Hatstall like Harry, and perhaps chose Gryffindor especially because it was after his father went to Azkaban for attacking Muggles, so maybe he didn't want to associate with that because a lot of people thought he was also Muggle-hating because they didn't know the real reason for his father's attack. But I think he would have gave some really great representation for Slytherin in the series, in the original series, pre-Cursed Child. He would have been a really cool contrast with Voldemort if they were both Slytherin and both cunning and both ambitious, especially in their youth, but then one chose good and one chose evil. And then I really buy young Dumbledore being a Slytherin. We don't really know much about him when he first came to Hogwarts, so like at age 11, but I think maybe if you sorted him around the time he was graduating Hogwarts and meeting Grindelwald, which I'll get into a little bit later, I think he could have certainly been a Slytherin because he was very ambitious and he wanted power. He wanted to be like the master of death and the Hallows. But then when his sister died, he kind of held that back. And with the falling out with Grindelwald, some things changed in him.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because when I was first just kind of listening to you and glancing over that, I was like, well, Dumbledore is like the least ambitious character we meet in the entire series. You know, he had so many opportunities to become the Minister for Magic and he turned down every single one. He just wanted to be a teacher, kind of run Hogwarts separately, have his own thing. But if you think about him as a young adult, maybe he was ambitious. So you really do have to think about when you sort people because Dumbledore has gone through stuff and that changes people.
Yeah, Dumbledore himself has said that maybe we sort too early. So, I mean, even though he was a Gryffindor at that time, maybe if they had sorted later in his Hogwarts career, he would have been more of a Slytherin.
Yeah, so then moving on to his Patronus, so we know that it is a phoenix, and we just have a little bit of an excerpt from a MuggleNet article that talks about phoenixes and especially how it pertains to Albus Dumbledore. So, the only known possessor of this Patronus is Albus Dumbledore. The phoenix is known as the resurrection bird, dying in a glorious pyre of flames and then rising again to new life from the ashes. The phoenix lives to an immense age and can carry very heavy loads, and their tears have healing powers. Phoenixes are hard to domesticate, but they are loyal to their owners for a lifetime. Once their owner dies, they will not seek another master. If you are not Albus Dumbledore and happen to find yourself the possessor of a Phoenix Patronus, you are likely stronger spiritually than most anyone else, so much so that your love heals the spirits of those around you. No one can tame you or claim you in any way. You are very much a loner. At the same time, many admire and adore you for your strength, wisdom, and above all, immense power to love even your enemies. You do not fear death, but understand it is the next great adventure. And should you be faced with it, you will greet death like an old friend, especially if it means saving the life of another. And then, obviously, phoenixes are just kind of a symbol for renewal and rebirth and how they die and come back to life, this whole rebirth imagery. I'm sorry, I was trying to think of another word and I couldn't.
So Dumbledore's parents are Percival and Kendra Dumbledore. So Percival, as I kind of mentioned earlier, was imprisoned and sent to Azkaban in 1891 after three Muggle boys attacked Ariana because they saw her kind of doing some weird magic. And Percival, in response, attacked them, and everyone thought it was just an act of prejudice against Muggles, because the Dumbledore family kept it secret the real reason. They're very secretive about Ariana. And he purportedly died in Azkaban. But due to Crimes of Grindelwald, as we'll talk about next episode, we don't know. One of the theories is that he could have had another kid in Azkaban, and that could be Aurelius. We'll get into that. But Percival could become important. Kendra Dumbledore was a Muggle-born witch, and after Percival went to Azkaban, Kendra moved the Dumbledores to Godric's Hollow, and she devoted herself to caring for Ariana, but her version of caring was kind of keeping Ariana a secret. Like, no one really in Godric's Hollow knew that Ariana existed except for Bathilda Bagshot, who Kendra became close with. But Kendra then died in 1899 as the result of Ariana's uncontrolled magic, and Aberforth has kind of credited Albus learning all this secretive ways to Kendra because of kind of her covering up Ariana.
So Dumbledore's skills are, he's considered by many to be one of the most powerful wizards of his time. It's a pretty damn good skill.
And then his hobbies are 10-pin bowling and chamber music.
And he died on June 30th, 1997.
Rip.
Tear. His reading that section after he died and his funeral is one of the saddest portions of the book for me. Like, I don't cry every time I read every death in this series. Like, I cried during a lot of the first times, but every time I read Albus dying, I cry.
Yeah, Dumbledore's one of the hardest deaths for me.
The first time we hear Dumbledore mentioned is in the Sorcerer's Stone, and this is when he brings Harry to the Dursleys at the night his parents died. So, this is the first description we get of him. He was tall, thin, and very old, judging by the silver of his hair and beard, which were both long enough to tuck into his belt. He was wearing long robes, a purple cloak that swept the ground, and high-heeled buckled boots. His blue eyes were light, bright, which, if you go back, were the two words that Albus means. So his blue eyes were light, bright, and sparkling behind half-moon spectacles, and his nose was very long and crooked, as though it had been broken at least twice. So, we gather multiple things from this. One, Dumbledore might be gay. His buckled boots, his purple cloak, just got a funky, yeah, a sense of fashion at least. We learn that his nose has been broken, and we learn that at least one of these is from Aberforth. How else was it broken? Because it says it was broken at least twice, or looks as though it was broken at least twice. And we also just get a good idea of, one of my favorite images and imagery of Dumbledore is his sparkling eyes behind the half-moon spectacles, and I think that the man who played Dumbledore in the first two movies got this down pat. I have like different feelings about both of the actors, because I think that the first one was a little bit too old and frail to play Dumbledore, especially in some of the later books when he's fighting, but he just got Dumbledore's essence so much better than the second Dumbledore. Richard Harris, I think, was the second one. I can't remember the first one's name.
Oh, I just had it. Michael Gambon?
I think it's Richard Harris, Michael Gambon, actually. I think Michael Gambon.
Wait, what was the order? One.
Richard Harris, Michael Gambon. Was Michael Gambon the second one?
I think Gambon was the second one.
Yeah, yeah.
God, his Wikipedia is so long. Yeah, Michael Gambon portrayed Dumbledore for all of the remaining films. So Richard Harris was in Sorcerer's and Chamber.
Yeah.
Yeah. Regarding that description, just what you were saying about fashion, I'm just reminded of Crimes of Grindelwald, that three-piece suit. Dumbledore. Anyway, moving on. So, Dumbledore's Myers-Briggs personality type has been assigned ENFJ, which is interestingly dubbed the protagonist. And he's not Harry, but he is a pretty main character. So, protagonists are natural-born leaders that are full of passion and charisma. I think that pretty much sums up Dumbledore pretty well. He's a great leader. They form around 2% of the population and are oftentimes our politicians, our coaches, and our teachers, reaching out and inspiring others to achieve and to do good in the world. And their natural confidence begets influence. So, I think Dumbledore is really widely respected in the wizarding world. People at the Ministry, when they aren't, like, fighting with Dumbledore, like, Voldemort coming back, often, like, ask for his help and guidance. Like, he's been asked to be Minister of Magic so many times. Most right-minded people will pretty much follow him without question. There are the people that are like, Dumbledore's crazy, but I think all the people that, like, we respect in this series pretty much put all of their trust in Dumbledore, and he was the leader of the Order. So I think that's a pretty good, like, sum of his role in the wizarding world as a whole. Protagonists are supposed to radiate authenticity, concern, and altruism. They're unafraid to stand up and speak when they feel something needs to be said, and they find it natural and easy to communicate with others, especially in person. Dumbledore always spoke up for what he believed to be true and right. He believed Harry about Voldemort being back, and he stood up to the Ministry. As far as communication, I think a lot of people harp on him for what he chooses to tell people and not tell people, but you can clearly see how he can communicate what he wants to communicate very well. In the conversations we see with him one-on-one with Harry, and also the snippets we get of his conversations with Snape, is that he very easily, like, tells Snape what he wants Snape to know and gets Snape, is able to, like, manipulate Snape, I think, very well. The interest protagonists have in others is genuine, almost to a fault. When they believe in someone, they can become too involved in the other person's problems and place too much trust in them. Luckily, this trust tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, as protagonists' altruism and authenticity inspire those they care about to become better themselves. But if they aren't careful, they can overextend their optimism, sometimes pushing others further than they're ready or willing to go. I feel like Dumbledore would, like, is smart enough to see this fault in himself, and I think that could partially be kind of a concern about his, a personal concern about his relationship with Harry. Perhaps he, one of the reasons he distanced himself, besides just the mind connection with Voldemort, would be that he didn't want to, like, push Harry too far too fast, and I think that's one of the reasons why he kind of holds out the Harry's true purpose and everything. All through the hunt for Horcruxes, Harry knew that Dumbledore believed in him, and that kind of gave Harry the will he needed to know that he could do anything. His confidence does waver a bit due to, like, what other people say about Dumbledore, Rita Skeeter, or, like, Ron saying, oh, you don't even know what you're supposed to be doing. But Harry knows deep down that Dumbledore believed he could do this, and that is what keeps him going. And I think that's, like, one of Dumbledore's really good strengths, is that he can inspire people like that. People with protagonist personality types are passionate altruists, sometimes even to a fault. So they're unlikely to be afraid to take the slings and arrows while standing up for the people and ideas they believe in. And then protagonists are, like, cultural or political icons. And I think Dumbledore took all the bad things people had to say about him and didn't really care that people were saying those things. Because he knew he was right and he believed in Harry. And, like, he took the fall for Dumbledore's army, even though he had nothing to do with it. But he was, like, he believed in what Harry was doing. And so he was willing to, like, take the downfall for that. So some strengths are that they're tolerant, reliable, charismatic, altruistic, and natural leaders, which, again, I may be biased, but I see all of those in Dumbledore. And then weaknesses, overly idealistic, too selfless, too sensitive, fluctuating self-esteem, and struggle to make tough decisions. I'm not sure how I feel about those. Overly idealistic, I wonder how that would come into play with, like, his relationship with Grindelwald, and, like, Dumbledore thought that they were doing, like, what they were saying was actually for the greater good, and, like, maybe he was idealistic about that and overlooked, like, Grindelwald's dark tendencies.
I think he was overlooking them for a different reason as well.
Oh!
If you know what I mean.
An interesting thing about romantic relationships for this personality type is that they're supposed to feel most at home and comfortable when in a relationship, but Dumbledore, as far as we know, his only love interest was Grindelwald. And after that, he, like, chose to be on his own and is totally a loner. And I'm going to talk about this in a couple sections later. So that's kind of contradictory to what we know about Dumbledore. And then, as a final little part of this, I wanted to talk about parenthood, because I figured this would be kind of where we could gain some insight to Dumbledore's relationship with Harry, because he does kind of take on a parental role with him. And protagonist parents are supposed to take pride in nurturing and inspiring strong values, and they take care to ensure that the basis for these values comes from understanding and not blind obedience. And I think this is true, that Dumbledore wanted Harry to learn from experience and to truly understand things. Like, all of his testing Harry, as people may say, was training him to, like, get him to have these strong values and bring out these strong values and teach him the best he could be without Dumbledore just outright saying, like, you need to do this or you need to be like this. He was, like, letting Harry learn this for himself. Whatever their children need in order to learn and grow, protagonist parents give the time and energy necessary to provide it. And I think this is probably not really true with Dumbledore. He always did what he thought was best for Harry, but that's maybe not what was actually best for Harry. So if you think about distancing himself in the Order of the Phoenix, that, like, kind of exacerbated Harry's struggles during that year. And finally, this is a sentence I found particularly interesting. It says, while in their weaker moments, they may succumb to more manipulative behavior, protagonists mostly rely on their charm and idealism to make sure their children take these lessons to heart. Manipulative behavior. As a Dumbledore lover, I can admit that he is manipulative.
But he's manipulative for a good cause.
Yeah, he has a reason.
Yes.
But, like, I'm willing to sacrifice that and say he's manipulative. And I think that's one of his biggest flaws. And for some people, that makes, like, totally ruins him as a person. Obviously, for us, it doesn't. But like Snape said, like, you've raised him like a pig for slaughter. Like, Dumbledore was manipulative with Harry, but he had his reasons. And in the end, Harry did take Dumbledore's lessons to heart. Even though Dumbledore may have manipulated him some, Harry, I think, falls back on, like, who he knew Dumbledore to be.
I think this might be getting a little bit off topic, but just talking about his manipulativeness, I think that's something that you need to keep in mind, that Dumbledore cared for Harry as well. Like, he didn't do this as this, like, emotionless, like, godfather background character just pulling the strings on Harry. He really did care and love Harry. And I think that makes what he did even more brave and heroic, because he knew that the more time he spent with this boy, the more he was going to love him, but he needed to make sure that Harry knew what he had to do and knew, at least, Dumbledore didn't tell him everything, I'm not saying that, but that he knew who he was and who Voldemort was and how he could use his strengths against Voldemort, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. I think that it kind of is the big thing for me, that he really did care about Harry, and I think that makes the manipulation better. I know some people might think that makes it worse, but I think that it shows that he really cared about Harry, and he put everyone, the greater good, above his own love, and I think that's really admirable.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So next I'm just going to have kind of a short little section on his childhood / time at Hogwarts, because we do know quite a bit about his early life from different sources, like The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore by Rita Skeeter, and also the obituary in the paper by Alpheus Doge. So we kind of get we get some of the same facts in both of those things, but obviously different contexts and different ways that those facts are painted. So we know that when he was a child, his father attacked a couple of Muggle boys for tormenting his sister Ariana. And I think there's been some, like, speculation about how badly Ariana was treated by these boys, and whether this kind of was the instance that kicked off her becoming an Obscurial. And then also to the extent of which Percival Dumbledore attacked these boys, because, I mean, it did get him a life sentence in Azkaban.
Yeah.
And I know that kind of, like, wizarding Crime and Punishment is a little bit iffy, because if you get sent to Azkaban, like, it's a life sentence. You don't come out of Azkaban, which I feel like there needs to be a middle ground there somewhere. Maybe, like, 2 years lockup without Dementors, but anyways, so, and after this, like I said, his father was put in Azkaban for it. So when Dumbledore arrived at Hogwarts in 1892, he kind of was treated like an outcast, because people would always be whispering about him and his family, and then people also thought that he would be a Muggle hater like his father, because the facts of why his father was in Azkaban was kind of
hidden.
distorted, yeah. And so people thought that he just came from a family of Muggle haters and Albus was another one of those. But as we know, that's not really the case. And then he also met Alpheus Doge on his first day at Hogwarts and befriended him, which I think is really cool to think about because Alpheus Doge arrived to Hogwarts still recovering from dragonpox. And so he was like green and had all of these scars and like pustules on him. And Dumbledore was still willing to be friends with him and befriend him. And they obviously their friendship continued because we know that at the end, after graduation, they were planning on going on a world trip together, but then Dumbledore's
mother died.
Yeah, because he then has to go home to take care of his sister and brother. And so, like I mentioned before, there are lots of whispers around him at school at the very beginning, but then he quickly proved that he was a real talent in his early years at Hogwarts. And so there's a quote from Alpheus Doge in the obituary that says, he not only won every prize of note that the school offered, but he was in regular correspondence with the most notable magical names of the day, including Nicholas Flamel, Bathilda Bagshot, and Albert Waffling. And so we know Nicholas Flamel was the celebrated alchemist, and Bathilda Bagshot is one of the best magical historians. And then Albert Waffling is a transfiguration scholar. I think he actually wrote some of the textbooks for transfiguration that the children use at Hogwarts. And we know that Dumbledore did have a particular interest in transfiguration because we know at one point he was a professor of transfiguration. We also know at one point he possibly was the professor of Defense Against the Dark Arts, which, whatever, not what we're here to talk about today. So some of the prizes that he won while at Hogwarts were the Barnabas Finkley Prize for Exceptional Spell Casting. He became the British Youth Representative to the Wizengamot, and he received the gold medal for groundbreaking contribution to the International Alchemical Conference in Cairo. So he basically was an overachiever, and from a very young age, people knew he had the potential to become the greatest wizard of all time.
Just a correction. I think this might have spell corrected when you put it in, but I think Albert Waffling's name is actually Adalbert Waffling.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I typed it from the book, so yeah. I probably just...
That's probably what happened.
My bad. And then, so just some stuff that we know that he was involved in or we know happened during his time at Hogwarts. So we know he studied ancient runes as one of his elective courses starting in the third year. In his fourth year, we know that he set fire to the dormitory bed curtains. He says this was an accident, but we also know that he was never a fan of them. So, accident? Maybe. Here, his love of fashion just coming back again.
Interior decorating.
Come on, guys. The clues are there. And then we also know that he was made prefect in his fifth year and then head boy in his seventh year. And we also know that from a young age, his passion lay in teaching. I think Alpheus Doge says something along these lines. I could be wrong, but I remember seeing a quote that, like, he was always passionate about teaching the next generation. He never was, at this point at least, never was super interested in becoming, joining the ministry and kind of gaining power. He knew that his love lay in teaching. And Grindelwald.
Yeah.
Good segue to our next section.
So, this next section, I've entitled Dumbledore and Grindelwald, What We Know. Because, obviously, I think we're going to learn a lot more about this in the coming Fantastic Beasts films. This is just kind of this is what we have the facts on. And there's certainly a lot more theories and everything out there, but I don't think we're going to get into that in this episode. So, immediately after Hogwarts, Albus was... supposed to depart on a grand tour of the world, like Katie said, with his friend Alpheus Doge, but he had to stay behind due to his mother's death. So then, following the death, he returned to Godric's Hollow and started taking care of his sister Ariana. And Grindelwald, at this time, was in Godric's Hollow staying with his great aunt Bathilda Bagshot, who was one of the Dumbledore family's only friends in Godric's Hollow. And I think this is following Grindelwald's expulsion from Durmstrang. And so Bathilda introduced the two because I don't know. She thought they would be compatible.
I think that there's something saying that she thought Dumbledore was so lonely because he was just taking care of his siblings, and so she wanted him to have a friend.
Yep, it's really cute. But, Bathilda, really? Turn of events. So, Grindelwald was studying the Deathly Hallows at the time, and he kind of roped Albus into this, and the two became obsessed with them. They really wanted to find the Deathly Hallows and, like, become the all-powerful Master of Death. And they both kind of had this saying where they said, for the greater good. They actually never meant the same thing by this, which Rita Skeeter, kind of in her The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, tries to paint Dumbledore as this evil, dark wizard who was, like, in it from the start with Grindelwald, but that's not really the case. I think for Dumbledore, he truly meant for the greater good. He's a very, like, utilitarian character. And Grindelwald, on the other hand, for the greater good to him meant, like, wizards in power over muggles. He thought, I don't know if he truly thought that was the best for everyone, but he clearly thought that was the best for him, and that is what went on to spur I don't know. Is it called, like, the global wizarding war? I think that's what it's called. It's not the first wizarding war, even though the first wizarding war comes after it.
Yes.
Basically, it's World War II. So we know that at some point during this summer, which really this whole little affair was just a summer, they made a blood pact, and it seems that the, like, conditions of that blood pact were that neither could move against the other. Aberforth, who was home from Hogwarts at the time, he's younger than Albus, but it was over the summer, he confronted Albus about his ambitions, and he was concerned that Albus would just leave Ariana behind. And then shots were fired, a duel kind of ensued between all three young men when Aberforth confronted this. And Ariana, the story goes is that Ariana got caught in the crossfire and died. There are speculations regarding what we now know from the Fantastic Beasts series about maybe they were performing some sort of magic trying to separate Ariana from her Obscurus, and that could have been the cause of her death. But that is the story as we are told it in the Harry Potter series, is that she kind of got caught in the crossfire and was just a casualty of this fight between the three young men. And Grindelwald subsequently fled. So at some point after this, we know that Grindelwald tracked down the Elder Wand and kind of started his rise to power. As he gained power, it was believed that Dumbledore would be the only person who could defeat him. At this point, Dumbledore is off at Hogwarts. And Dumbledore is, again, not able to move against him. He doesn't tell anyone why, but he says that he refuses kind of to move against him. He sends Newt kind of in his stead and everything. But this is because they had sworn a blood pact. And then in Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald, we know that Niffler, Newt's Niffler, steals the blood pact. And this occurs in 1927. And so Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald ends with Dumbledore saying he thinks he might be able to do something to break it. And then since we don't have the final three movies now and we have to wait for so long, the next thing we know is that in 1945, Dumbledore and Grindelwald duel. And so we assume that by this point he has broken the blood pact in some way. And it's said to be one of the greatest wizarding duels of all time. I believe Elpheus Doge is the one who says this. And Dumbledore defeats Grindelwald, which ends the war. Grindelwald becomes imprisoned. Dumbledore won the Elder Wand's allegiance. And then presumably had that allegiance until the night on the Astronomy Tower where Draco Malfoy disarmed him. So that's kind of the basics of the Dumbledore-Grindelwald history. I'm going to get in a little later with more about their actual relationship, because we do know that it was a romantic relationship in some capacity, as JK has said, but we don't know the facts of that yet. As it didn't come out in Crimes of Grindelwald, and hopefully will in the future.
Yeah, I have thoughts on the whole, like, Dumbledore being gay thing and how that was, like, received by the public, especially, but we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
just kind of thinking it with the Blood Pact, I wonder what makes a blood pact different than an unbreakable vow. Because from what we know about a blood pact, an unbreakable vow does the same thing.
Right.
Basically, because what we know about the blood pact is it prevented Dumbledore and Grindelwald from fighting each other in some way or shape or form. But they could have also accomplished that with an unbreakable vow. So I wonder what the difference is between the two.
Except, well, the blood pact we know gets broken. Unless we don't know what the punishment for breaking a blood pact is. So
yeah.
I'm just kind of thinking of this on the spot, but what if Dumbledore is never able to break it and undo it? And he does move against Grindelwald because that is like, he sees that as the only choice he has, but then maybe he does deal with the consequences and it's not death like an unbreakable vow is. So maybe we just don't know what those consequences are.
Yeah, and then also I just want to say that basically from the first time I finished the series, you know how people always have these, like, what's the one question you would ask J.K. Rowling if you ever met her? My question was always, how the fuck did Dumbledore defeat Grindelwald if Grindelwald was the one who had the unbeatable wand? Yeah. And I think that I'm going to get an answer to this in the Fantastic Beasts series, and I'm so excited because that was one thing that always bothered me. And I think I was always able to kind of rationalize it to myself because I knew they had a relationship that maybe Grindelwald was kind of like... defeated on purpose, if that makes sense, kind of gave up in a sense. And I'm not saying that I'm ruling that out, but I know that the main, this is kind of getting into the relationship again, but I know that the main, like, prevailing theory is that Grindelwald was just using Dumbledore. I don't know if I believe that. Or I know if I want to believe that, at least.
Yeah, as far as the Elder Wand, that's also been one of my big questions, because we see the Elder Wand change allegiances and get taken, but I don't think we've ever seen it happen in a duel. And this, it's said to be one of the greatest wizarding duels of all time. Like, that seems to me like both of them were giving it their all. So I've always questioned, how did that turn over? But I think we know that the Elder Wand is not... it's, quote, unbeatable, but it's really not.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think that's kind of the same with all the Hallows. I really don't think that they are these all-powerful... items that people think they are. I think that they're all just kind of these old, maybe uses more old magic and is a little bit more powerful, but it's not these like all powerful things because they all have flaws, as we see in the Tale of the Three Brothers.
Yeah. But let's move on.
Anyway, so I'm going to go through a little bit just about Dumbledore's relationship with Harry because I think that it's a particularly interesting one and one of the relationships we see the most throughout the series. So I'm just kind of going to go book by book and kind of talk about where their interaction was and kind of how they interacted. So I haven't done a reread of the books in probably about like 3 months, so I might be a little rusty. But I think that throughout the first book, Dumbledore doesn't really have that close of a relationship with Harry. Like, at this point, he's mainly just kind of like sitting back and observing Harry throughout his first year. We do see that he does say something along the lines of when Harry arrived at Hogwarts, he was more unfed and more unloved than he was hoping he would be when he showed up, because he's the one who obviously left him with the Dursleys. And so he wasn't very pleased with how they treated Harry. And I think, I could be wrong, but I know he kind of confronts the Dursleys and Half-Blood Prince when he comes to pick up Harry, so he might have said something along those lines then, and he kind of bashes them for being like, listen, you weren't just bad parents to Harry, you were bad parents to Dudley too, and it's like,
yeah,
damn.
And abusive, but...
Yes, for sure. And so the first book, we don't really see that much of a close relationship between them. Harry just is kind of as normal of a pupil as Harry Potter could be at this point. We do know that Dumbledore kind of gives him all the points in the end, so we kind of see his favoritism.
Maybe that's the biggest argument for Dumbledore being a Gryffindor.
his pure bias towards Harry and the Gryffindors in every situation ever. And then, so in Chamber of Secrets, Harry, I think, we see Harry summoned up to Dumbledore's office in the midst of him being accused of being the heir of Slytherin and being the one opening the Chamber of Secrets. And this is, I love this scene because Hagrid's like pounding on the, like runs in and is like, don't, Professor Harry couldn't have done this. He's this great guy. And Dumbledore is like, I know Hagrid. I never thought it was Harry. Please calm down. And Hagrid's like carrying dead chickens or something. Oh, it's like dead hens because... Or roosters, because a rooster's cry is fatal to a basilisk, and so all the roosters are shown up dead. Major foreshadowing. But, so that, like, that's mainly the gist of their relationship in Chamber of Secrets. But also in Chamber of Secrets, Dumbledore gets confirmation that Horcruxes are a thing, which I'll talk a little bit later when I go through his master plan and kind of how that all played out. And he kind of gains this more respect for Harry, I think, and is willing to... Because he knows the prophecy at this point. He heard the prophecy when it was given back when Harry was a baby, I think. And so he knows that Harry is the one chosen to defeat the Dark Lord. At this point, he knows that Voldemort isn't gone for good. And so he starts to think, like... I think at this point, he starts to believe that Harry... could be the one and kind of starts to pay more attention to him and starts to take more of an interest in Harry. And then throughout the third book, they just kind of start to cultivate a little bit more of a personal relationship. I don't think anything stands out to me about them, but we do know that Dumbledore is the one that suggests to Harry and Hermione to go back in time and that they could save two lives, not just one. And so we see that, like, Dumbledore treats Harry very differently than any other pupil, and whether that's right or wrong, he does. And so we see this kind of just come out more and more throughout the series, especially in the upcoming books. So in the fourth book, I couldn't really think of any situation in particular where they got super close, or spend a lot of time together, but Dumbledore does take a backseat also. Like, this backseat could be explained by him not being able to help Harry throughout the tasks of the Triwizard Tournament. Like, that's, he's a judge, that would be very unethical. But at the end, he's the one who saves Harry from Barty Crouch Jr., and he believes Harry right off the bat when Harry tells him that Voldemort is back.
This is the book where they have that big, like, meeting in his office at the end, right? Like, Sirius comes in as Padfoot, and they yes. all, like, sit in Dumbledore's office together. And I feel like this is kind of the first time that Dumbledore spends, like, a significant amount of time with Harry and, like, lets him, like, vent everything out. And some people have pointed to this as a time when Dumbledore should have told Harry everything.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think that this, my own personal opinion, you guys know that at this point that I'm a Dumbledore supporter, so this could be a little bit biased. But also at this point, I don't think it was the right time to tell Harry everything. He literally was 14 years old and just watched one of his friends die in front of his eyes and watched Voldemort come back from the come back from his baby version. So I think that it might have been a little bit overwhelming for him to hear all of this at this point. He was very, like, emotional, and it just would have been a bad idea, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is kind of when Harry first sees Dumbledore get into action. This is the first time he sees him as not just kind of a headmaster, but the ringleader of the good side of this war. He starts to kind of be like, okay, this is what we need to do. This is what's going to happen. This is how we're going to counteract when I know what's going to happen. And also, Harry sees him kind of tell Fudge all these things, and Fudge obviously just straight up ignores Dumbledore. And so then when all the things that Dumbledore predicts does happen, it just kind of reinforces that Dumbledore is basically this, like, all-knowing, all-powerful wizard. He's never said... Everything he guesses and everything he predicts actually happens. Mm. He's just so good. And then... So then in the Order of the Phoenix, Dumbledore... This kind of becomes a strain in the relationship, because Dumbledore starts to pull away from Harry because he's afraid of the connection that Voldemort has with Harry, and he's afraid that him being around is going to strengthen that connection. And then he also instructs Snape to teach him occlumency, which then just sours Harry even more towards Dumbledore because he hates Snape, and Dumbledore is the one forcing them to spend time together when Dumbledore could be the one teaching him these lessons. And then at the end, we see Dumbledore come and duel Voldemort at the Ministry of Magic, which is really cool.
So cool.
And that's one of the best scenes, like, one of my favorite scenes, I think, in all the movies. Mm. It's so cool. And then even in the book, we finally get to see kind of Dumbledore in action for the first time. Yeah. Like, him actually be this great wizard that we've always heard of him being. But then when they get back to Hogwarts, Harry throws the temper tantrum to end all temper tantrums and basically blames Dumbledore for everything. And whether you think that blame is right or not, Harry kind of, like, it makes it more personal than it needs to be and kind of destroys his office and is just, I mean, I know he's very emotional. I know he just watched his godfather die. I know he just kind of fought Voldemort and everything, but it's just a little bit of an overreaction in my opinion. But teenagers will be teenagers. And then in the sixth book is when we really see this Harry Dumbledore relationship. We see how close they've become and how close they are and how much Harry relies on Dumbledore for a lot of things, because throughout this book, Dumbledore gives Harry his, like, personal lessons. Mm-hmm. And so he uses this time to teach Harry everything he knows about Voldemort and everything he knows about Horcruxes. Everything in quotation marks. Okay, guys, I understand.
This might be, I'm, like, trying to figure out why Half-Blood Prince is my favorite book. I feel like I've been, like, trying to, like, justify this for a while. I just know it is. But now that I'm thinking about it, like, I think this might be one of the reasons. I mean, obviously, Dumbledore's death at the end gets me every time. But, like, the relationship between them throughout this book, I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, I think this book is a lot of where we see the Dumbledore being compared to a father figure mm-hmm. for Harry yeah. kind of come out, because he really does take Harry under his wing. And I know he doesn't tell Harry everything, but when we go back and we see Snape's memories about how much Dumbledore doesn't want to tell Harry these things because he knows how hard it's going to be for Harry. Like, he does it all to protect Harry. Again, I think he's very misunderstood. And then obviously, he dies, and Harry takes this death really hard. I think he might take it a little bit harder than he takes Sirius's death. I think he's less emotional when Dumbledore dies than he was when Sirius died. But I think this is kind of the moment. I mean, we talked a lot about his death in the death episode. But it's one of these turning points for Harry when he kind of realizes that this is real and that he's going to have to step up and do all of the things that Dumbledore asked of him. You know, he's not able to rely on Dumbledore anymore.
And I think this is, like, the beginning of the end for him. And you see that with, like, the choices he makes and how he's like, I'm not coming back to Hogwarts, and he breaks up with Ginny and all that stuff.
Yeah, and I think that from that point on, after Dumbledore dies, he almost lives his life. Maybe not so much of what would Albus Dumbledore do, but, like, what would Albus Dumbledore want me to do kind of thing. Like, what did he ask of me, and I have to get it done. And then in Deathly Hallows, I know that Dumbledore's dead at this point, but their relationship changes a lot after Dumbledore dies, because Harry starts to learn all of these things that he didn't know about Dumbledore before through Rita Skeeter, Aunt Muriel, and Alpheus Doge at Bill and Fleur's wedding. And so he starts to kind of doubt his relationship with Dumbledore. He always thought that they were so close. And then he learns all of these things that Dumbledore didn't tell him. And so he starts to question whether Dumbledore actually, like, thought of Harry as a close friend or a close confidant. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, with the life and lives of Albus Dumbledore, Harry learns about this whole other side of Dumbledore that he knew nothing about, and starts to even doubt whether Dumbledore was who he said he was. And then he does get closure at King's Cross after he dies the first time. And I think that, I mean, we don't see him die a second time, but he does. So, or will, I guess. He's only, like, 40 at this point, or 39. But yeah, I think that that scene is really important to Harry, but also to the readers, because I think that was J.K.'s time and place to redeem Dumbledore, because the whole stuff in the book is basically Harry doubting Dumbledore and whether he did the right thing and whether Dumbledore is a good guy. But then we see him at King's Cross and he's still just the same Dumbledore he always was.
Yeah.
So I think that it's really cool. That's one of my favorite scenes.
I think how I interpret Deathly Hallows is, like, Harry is being forced, like you said, to doubt Dumbledore because of all these other people and what everyone else is saying. And I think deep down he always knew that Dumbledore was, like, who he knew him to be. And I think the King's Cross scene is just that confirmation. It's like, no, Harry, like, you were right to keep fighting, to keep looking for the Horcruxes and all of that. Like, it's like the justification that, like, Harry, you did the right thing by standing by me, even though you did doubt because what everyone else said.
Yeah, I totally agree.
All right. Now on to the section that we've kind of already, like, been bordering into. So this is about JK revealing, after all of the books that come out, that Dumbledore is gay. So in October of 2007, she revealed in a fan Q&A when someone asked, like, did Dumbledore ever, like, have love or find love? She revealed that she always thought of Dumbledore as gay. And she said that Dumbledore and Grindelwald's relationship was romantic. Dumbledore was kind of, like, smitten and in love with Grindelwald, and then shocked and horrified when Grindelwald revealed his true nature. So this is, of course, hinted at in Deathly Hallows with the mentions of Dumbledore and Grindelwald's relationship, but it's not explicitly said to be romantic in any way, so a lot of fans interpret this as just close friends. And, like, my issue with this is, like, okay, if it was Dumbledore and, like, some dark witch, like, you know, soon to be dark witch, everyone would have been like, oh, they're totally dating, they're totally in love. But everybody's so heteronormative that they can't see that this was clearly a romantic relationship, at least on one side.
Is that what you were going to say? No. I kind of have a, like, I agree with everything that you just said, but I also kind of think about this as, what perspective are we seeing this from? We're seeing this from Rita Skeeter's perspective through somebody who was there at the time, yeah. But whether or not, I don't know really anything about the LGBTQ plus laws and stuff in the wizarding world, but it might be seen kind of how it is in the normal world, like, kind of a little bit taboo, and even more taboo then, because this was in the
1890s, early 1900s. Like, they definitely kept it a secret.
Yeah, so exactly. This isn't coming from Grindelwald's perspective. This isn't coming from Dumbledore's perspective. It's coming from an outsider's perspective that they could have easily hidden their feelings for. And also, it's never explicitly said that they, like, were actually romantic with each other. It just, Dumbledore had feelings for, you know. So a lot of people are like, well, she didn't explicitly say it. I'm like, well, but, yeah. Bubble, like what I just said, you know.
We'll get there. So JK also has said, I believe this was in this, I actually don't know. She said this in an interview, and she said, he lost his moral compass completely when he fell in love, and I think subsequently became very mistrustful of his own judgment in those matters, so became quite asexual. He led a celibate and bookish life. So subsequently, after Grindelwald's relationship, any whatever kind of relationship it was with Grindelwald, Dumbledore, I totally see Dumbledore doing this and being like, no, like, I became a fool when I was in love with him. Like, I almost became, like, complicit with, like, the worst dark wizard ever. And I can see him totally just, like, swearing off all romantic involvement. And I think this is kind of JK's justification for why we don't see Dumbledore's being gay in the actual series. So another thing that she has said about it is that she had to ask scriptwriters at one point to take out a line where Dumbledore reminisces about a girl that he once loved. So, like, she did have this in mind. Well, I'll get into this. So the reaction from fans, some fans praised this as great LGBTQ representation since, like, he's a major character in a major series, and we don't see that a lot. I mean, it's getting to be that way more, but it's kind of usually just assumed that all characters are straight. So, like, to have this, that you know, that's pretty good, even if it's not perfect. Many fans, though, critiqued JK, and their critiques come from the fact that the only LGBTQ character is not really represented as being LGBTQ in the series, right? Someone tweeted that they, quote, couldn't see Dumbledore as gay. And JK's response, which I love, is, quote, maybe it's because gay people look like just people. Like, that part of the critique frustrates me, because people, I think, want sexuality to be a defining aspect of a character when that sexuality is not heterosexual. So, like, Harry's straight. That's not a defining aspect of who he is. So why does Dumbledore being gay have to be a defining aspect of who he is? I do understand the critiques. I'll talk about my personal thoughts a little bit later, but I do understand the critiques that, like, it's not, at least in the series, the book series as we have it, without anything else, it's not a really a great representation. And I think there could have been much better representation. I would have loved to see some LGBTQ students at Hogwarts. I think that would have been great, especially for, like, LGBTQ young readers. So it's not great representation, but I think the critiques against JK are a little unwarranted.
Yeah, I think that a common thing, especially it's kind of become a meme now, like, all those memes, like, you're not gay unless JK Rowling tells you are, kind of this whole theme of her, like, retconning the series and basically, like, throwing him. I think that's kind of bullshit, in my opinion, because if we sit back and we look at all the other professors, I know nothing about their sexuality. We don't know about McGonagall till after the series is over with the e-books. Yeah. We know nothing about Flitwick, nothing about Professor Sprout, like, so why did we need to know about Dumbledore's sexuality throughout the series? It wasn't pertinent to the storyline. I understand that it's kind of disappointing to not have an active representation throughout the series, but I also think it's unfair to, like, critique her for not making it super explicit in this series and kind of, like, well, you didn't think that. You're just saying that now to, like, appease people. Right. You know, like, do you see where I'm coming from? Like,
yeah, I totally understand.
She didn't... I think it would have been extra weird for her to, like, just be like, oh, buy it, like, have a want.
Just to, like, throw it in there.
Yeah. That's not what I think that would have, I think that probably would have been just as bad or even worse than what she did now. It's like, she's, the way that she's coming from it is like, oh, this character is just gay. Like, what do you mean? Like, that's who he is, you know?
Right. So I think my personal issue with the representation is not, like, regarding Dumbledore. It's just I would have liked to see better representation. And, like, I agree. I think that throughout, like, many issues in the series, you know, like, Dean is the only black character, or there are a few others. Dean's the only black student, and then you have Pavarti, who's Indian, like, but, I mean, they are in England, and they're mostly white, but that's why I really love the, like, cursed child Hermione, who's a woman of color and stuff like that. Like, obviously there are issues, but I think we're being a little too harsh with the Dumbledore thing.
I think so, too. And I think it's been taken out of context. Like I said, especially recently, I've seen so many memes about, like, J.K. Rowling assigning sexualities to people and just kind of arbitrarily. It's her world. Also, I don't know.
I think this comes up with so much of the series, but, like, what we have in the books is so little of what JK's world is. Like, she has so much in her head. She has crafted this all, and she gives us what she wants to give us. So, like, just because it's not in the books, it doesn't mean it's not true. Like, we can't, I don't know, you can't like claim that she's wrong, or, you know, like, she's had this, and it, and the thing I like about this is that it does serve a purpose, and I think we'll see that purpose with Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, so, no, I totally agree.
Getting back to my notes, Fantastic Beasts series is supposed to explore his sexuality and particularly the relationship with Grindelwald, which JK has recently said that this relationship was, quote, quite intense and passionate. So haven't seen a ton about his sexuality or the relationship yet in the series. I mean, we're only two movies in, and Dumbledore wasn't in the first one, but we have seen hints to it. We know that Dumbledore did have the connection with Grindelwald, and they made a blood pact. Some of our questions that kind of have spurred, like, we don't know, was this a one-way relationship? Like Katie kind of said, people have hinted or thought that it maybe Dumbledore was just in love with Grindelwald and Grindelwald exploited him. I would like to think that there maybe, like, that's the human part of Grindelwald, is that he did care for Dumbledore a little bit. That's, like, the big question. Was Grindelwald using Dumbledore? Was it a one-way relationship? What was the extent of this? And really, I just want, like, I want to know the details. A lot of people want to see Jude Law and Johnny Depp kiss.
I think that if they did show them kiss, it would be
the younger ones.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Jamie Campbell Bower and whoever played young Dumbledore
young
in Dumbledore. The mirror. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that, and especially, we've seen a lot of criticism for JK in the Fantastic Beasts series by not making that relationship more explicit. And I do, like, if she doesn't in the preceding movies, I'll be upset about it. I think that there's really time to explore that relationship, especially when the backstory behind the blood pack gets explained. Like, I think seeing a scene where they make that would be really good, and kind of having their relationship be shown more explicit then.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I was like, I think we're going to see flashbacks from Dumbledore's perspective.
For sure.
When he's trying to destroy the blood pact. And then, of course, we're going to see them on screen together in the duel. And I wonder, because I'm assuming, everybody's assuming we'll see the duel because it's 1945 is the end date.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming, I'm kind of hoping that there's dialogue in that duel. I think it's going to be a super cool duel as far as magic wise, but I hope that they interact in some way. Cause we know that they both survive it. So I feel like there's gotta be some sort of, maybe even just glances and stuff.
Like when they're just standing there circling each other, yeah. When nobody's done the first spell, just
I don't know. This is one of the things I'm most excited for in the Fantastic
Beasts. Yeah.
But we're getting into our next episode.
We are.
So I just want to wrap up this section, which I've kind of said all of this before, but I just wanted to put my thoughts out there in one cohesive sentence. So, or paragraph. I do understand the complaints that the only LGBTQ representation is not explicitly stated in the series. I do think that that's kind of problematic, but I also understand JK's point. And I think it would have been really nice to see other queer relationships and such in the original series, but I'm really excited for Fantastic Beasts. And I think that will show people that JK had this in her mind all along. Like, she's not throwing it in later to make up for lack of representation. Like, this is kind of a key plot point. So that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, I kind of jumped in and showed, or told my thoughts on it already, so I won't really go into it more. But we are running a little bit long, so I'm going to try and breeze through this section,
even though
it's kind of a doozy. Yeah. So I'm just going to go through Dumbledore's master plan. I had trouble organizing this because I wasn't sure whether I should do it in chronological order throughout the series or when it actually happened, because we see flashbacks and we learn that Dumbledore learned things. So this might be a little bit disorganized. Just bear with me here. So we know that basically the night after Voldemort died, Dumbledore did not believe that he was gone for good. We know that right off the bat, he knew that Dumbledore was probably going to come back and that this conflict wasn't done yet. And then we also learn that he kind of always had his suspicions about Voldemort and his Horcruxes. We knew that he suspected that probably at least one. We knew he expected probably more than one, but not really how many, what they are. And so throughout the series, starting from when Voldemort died to Book 7, when Voldemort is defeated for good, we see Dumbledore kind of learn all of these things and put these things together to create his master plan that he has and how that pertains to Harry. So, like I said, we learn in the first book that Dumbledore's theory of Voldemort being gone for good is confirmed, because we know that he's drinking unicorn's blood and trying to get the Sorcerer's Stone. But we also see him say something along the lines of, I knew the Sorcerer's Stone wasn't a long-term plan for him. We know that that was just him trying to get his body back and then use the Horcruxes that he had. Because I think Harry asked him at some point, why didn't he just use the Philosopher's Stone from the beginning? And Dumbledore says something like he never wanted to rely on something else to give him life. He wanted his own Horcruxes on his own terms. And then in the Chamber of Secrets, he gets confirmation that he did in fact make one Horcrux. So we know that kind of where he ended up after Voldemort died, everything he thought is in fact true. So this is when he kind of starts behind the scenes. We don't see him do this throughout the series, but I think this is when he really starts kind of looking into getting those memories that he shows Harry in the Half-Blood Prince and gathering information about what other Horcruxes Voldemort could have, how many they are, where they are, those kind of things. we also know that he knows that Voldemort was obsessed with becoming immortal. And so that's kind of something else that plays with his thinking of how many Horcruxes and how that all played out. And then throughout the fourth book, we really see Dumbledore pick up on a lot of signs that Voldemort could be on his way back. We know that Snape's dark mark is getting stronger, and we know that Snape showed him his dark mark and how it was getting stronger. And so then at the end of the book, we know his suspicion is confirmed that Voldemort is back, and Voldemort used Horcruxes to come back to life. And then I kind of alluded to this earlier when I was going through his relationship with Harry, but we see him predict everything that's going to happen to Fudge, and Fudge ignores Dumbledore, but Dumbledore is still proactive and starts up the Order of the Phoenix again to prepare for the fight. And then in the Order of the Phoenix, Dumbledore becomes very worried about the connection between Harry and Voldemort, and so he makes Harry start occlumency lessons to try and resist this connection, because again, Dumbledore predicts something correctly. He predicts that Voldemort is going to, if and when he finds out about this connection with Harry, he's going to use it to exploit Harry. So obviously he uses this at the end of Order of the Phoenix to lure Harry to the Ministry of Magic in the Hall of Prophecies and try and kill him there and get the prophecy at the same time. And then, so this connection proves to Dumbledore kind of another thing that he's always suspected, is that Harry, in fact, is a Horcrux himself for Voldemort. And this is when he starts, I think there's a quote in Order of the Phoenix actually at the end where there's a quote that says Dumbledore, he refers to his master plan and that Harry is going to be instrumental in saving the whole entire wizarding world. So at this point, we can kind of surmise that his master plan is complete. He just has to carry it out now. So obviously that plan is he's going to spend the next year teaching Harry everything he knows about Voldemort, everything he knows about Horcruxes, so that Harry is prepared to defeat the Horcruxes. And we know he obviously doesn't get around to telling Harry that he's a Horcrux himself and is going to have to die, but he sets up Harry for success in trying to get him to make sure he destroys the Horcruxes before he dies, because he knows that Harry is the chosen one, the one who is going to defeat the Dark Lord from the prophecy that he heard so many years ago. So it just kind of all starts to come together in the sixth book. And like I said, this is when he teaches Harry. And Harry learns really valuable things at this point. From what he learns from Dumbledore about Voldemort, he's able to not only find all the Horcruxes and what they are, but destroy them. I know that Dumbledore never really tells Harry how to destroy a Horcrux, but that's what he has Hermione for, so. And then, obviously, the master plan is complete when Snape gives Harry the memories, and finally Dumbledore, in effect, is able to tell Harry that he is a Horcrux and he just has to die at the correct time if he wants to defeat the Dark Lord. And then also, sorry, throughout this sixth book, he also is kind of hatching his side plan to his master plan and planning his death. So he knows this is after he puts on the ring that he finds at the end of... He finds it at some point in Order of the Phoenix, because in the beginning of the sixth book, his hand is... Yeah. So in between Order of the Phoenix and the Half-Blood Prince, he finds Marvolo's ring and destroys it. But before he destroys it, he puts it on because he knows it's the Resurrection Stone and he probably wants to see Ariana and apologize.
Also, he puts it on because that little part of him when he was young is still in there, that ambitious Slytherin part, and he still wants to be the Master of Death. He's still tempted by it.
Do you think he put it on because of that? I think he put it on to, like, try and... I think he put it on to see Ariana and apologize.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's probably a little bit of both.
I think
it's a little bit of both.
I think he still was tempted. Because he has the Elder Wand. And Harry has the cloak, but, like...
Yeah.
He knows where... Like, I think he's still tempted. I think there's still part of him in there.
And I think he even admits to a little bit of that in King's Cross. He says something like, I had all three at my disposal, you know, at this one point. He's such a compelling character. Like, you can fight with me about whether he's a good character or not, but he's such a well-crafted and compelling character. Yeah. And J.K. has so many characters that are like this, like, and Snape, it's just mind-blowing to me. Yeah,
like, Dumbledore and Snape, to me, like, we talked about, are kind of similar ideas, like, but opposite. And, like, Dumbledore, I still love and believe is a good person. Snape, I don't so much. But both of them, I just love the way they are written.
Yeah, they're so good. And then going kind of more through his, like, side plan, he wants to make sure that Snape is the one to kill him and not Draco. But there are also two motives for this. One, he doesn't want Draco to have to kill somebody. And two, he knows that if Snape kills him, he's not really defeating him because Dumbledore gave him permission to defeat him. So then the Elder Wand would die. But then that goes back to Grindelwald. So I was saying that, like, my theory for how he was defeated is kind of he, like, conceded. But then this would prove that Dumbledore doesn't think that's how the Elder Wand passes.
So Grindelwald must not have done that.
Do we think that Dumbledore got the wand from Grindelwald before the duel? Like, do we know for sure that Grindelwald had the wand in the duel? Maybe. Like, oh gosh, there's so many questions. I just need all of the movies out right now. Please and thank you. So that's kind of my summary of the master plan. I know I probably, like, glossed over some points, but I tried my best.
There will be more to discuss. True. But as far as the master plan and the manipulation, we kind of revealed our thoughts at the beginning. I just think that he had his reasons for everything, and he was ultimately doing this for the greater good, sacrificing Harry as well as himself. And you can harp on him for not telling Harry everything, but I don't think things would have played out correctly if he had told Harry, say, at the end of Goblet of Fire, that Harry needed to die. Like, that's not going to work. He needed Harry to
mature. It wasn't the time.
Okay, so I recently acquired a book called 50 Amazing Cocktails Inspired by Harry Potter. It's by Archie Thomas. It's unofficial and unauthorized. And it's basically just some, like, recipes for pretty, like, classic cocktails. Some of them are classic, some of them are a little bit more creative and specific, but they kind of assign cocktails and drinks to different characters and houses and such. So this is going to be a new part of our episodes where we say that just what the cocktail was. So Dumbledore's assigned cocktail is Dumbledore's Old Fashioned. It's just a straight up Old Fashioned, and the little description is, yes, we know he is. Very funny. This is another all-time classic cocktail that has been made by generations of bartenders and is traditionally served before dinner. So I kind of liked that one for Dumbledore because he is a bit of an old-fashioned guy.
Hi, my name is Larry, and I'm a Slytherin.
My name is Justin, and I'm a Slytherin.
And together we host the Here's Johnny podcast, where we take a look at horror movies, TV shows.
Oh, and games. We also have had amazing guests on the show that are directors, producers.
And don't forget, writers, Twitch streamers, and other podcasters.
Yeah, and you can also check out our show every Monday. Just search Here's Johnny Podcast in your podcast app of choice.
And you can always follow us on Twitter at Here's Johnny Cast. We are sure you will find an episode you will love. Maybe just like Ollivander's wands, an episode will pick you.
Pop quiz time! So this week's question is, what are some of the 12 uses of dragon's blood that Dumbledore does figure out? So we know two of them. We know that one is an oven cleaner, and we know that another use is a spot remover. I'm not sure what kind of spot. I'm not sure if it's like another stain remover or like a spot on your face, like pimple remover. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
But so we tried to be creative and come up with some other uses that could be part of the 12. But we do know that JK did send the list of 12 to a screenwriter that she worked with throughout the series. And he was the one who revealed the spot remover, and JK was the one who revealed the oven cleaner use. So do you have any ideas?
Yeah, so my answer is kind of on theme with what I was just talking about. But I think that I could totally see Dumbledore and, like, other bougie wizards using dragon's blood as, like, a flavoring for cocktails. Or, like, you put in a drop of dragon's blood. Like, I feel like that's, like, it would be, like, some, like, really, like, extravagant thing that people in the wizarding world do. And I think it'd be really funny.
Yeah, so I have a couple ideas. One came to me during the recording of this episode. I wonder if dragon's blood has anything to do with blood packs.
Yes.
that could be really interesting. I know that we see kind of blood come out of them, but I wonder if dragon's blood has anything to do with that. Two, my first thought was it has something to do with the cure for dragon pox, but I don't think that's correct. Somebody else comes up, I forget his name, but not Dumbledore, comes up with a cure for dragon pox, and then I'm not sure what the source on this was, but I found that Dumbledore himself was kind of like messing around with a cure in 1991, which I think is at the time that he is near the Philosopher's Stone. So I wonder if it's him experimenting with that for the cure for dragon pox. But also that comes out after he comes up with the 12 uses of dragon's blood. And then I was also thinking like kind of doing like more quirky things. It could be used for hair dye, you know? But we see it used in Half-Blood Prince when Horace Slughorn fakes the attack or stages the attack at his house when Dumbledore and Harry show up. I believe that he uses dragon's blood
interesting on the stuff. Walls.
Yeah.
So if you've made it through this episode, you probably know where to find us, but you should also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Tell your friends anywhere they find their podcasts, they can find us. We will continue to have our episodes released every Tuesday. This episode is coming out in July, so you've got like another couple months of that, less than 2 months of every week Wizard Studies. And please leave us a review. We really, really appreciate it.
And then you can find us on social media on Facebook and Instagram as Wizard Studies Podcast. And then we're also on Twitter as Wizard Studies. And then, as we mentioned throughout the episode, you can email us saying anything you want. Our email is Wizard Studies Podcast at... Yeah, don't do that. But if you have any suggestions, any thoughts, anything you want to tell us, you can email us at wizardstudiespodcast@gmail.com.
All right, thank you so much for listening, and remember, just do your best, we'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.